Let's start with this new article in Financial Times, in which it says Hungary has joined China's circle of friends to fight the US after Xi's visit to Europe. And it seems that this visit of Xi to Europe was so much important in terms of this pulling and pushing in Europe that is going on between the United States on one side and Russia and China on the other side. How do you see this Xi's visit to Europe?
Well, I find it highly interesting, and I'm glad you started out with that, Nima. You know, he visited Paris, and I'm sure he, I'm sure, I imagine very strongly that he told Macron, look, please, believe my Russian allies, my Russian colleagues, when they say that if you put French troops into Ukraine, they will come back in wooden boxes. So no fooling around, okay? Knock that off. Well, there were some spurious reports that there were already French foreign legionnaires in Ukraine. But in any case, the French foreign ministry quickly said, oh, no, we're not going to do that. Okay. Now, the next stop was Serbia. Now, she is a very talented and very practiced diplomat. Why did he pick that particular day to visit Serbia? Well, it became very clear in what he gave an interview about to the Serbian newspaper. He said, look, this is the 25th anniversary of when the U.S. bombed the hell, no, he didn't say, when the U.S. bombed our embassy in Belgrade. Okay, 25 years. We cannot put up with this kind of thing. And I'm here to recall that we don't forget things like that. Whoa, that's not very diplomatic. That's very pointed. Okay. The next thing you know, he's in Hungary. Now, Hungary has always been sort of the outlier in NATO and has refused to join in many of the NATO escapades, specifically having to do with Ukraine. So Orban, the head of Hungary, was already predisposed to entertain China and Xi personally, and to trade on the bilateral ties that they have been developing over recent years. In other words, Hungary has shown the rest of the EU, hey, we could still deal with China. And more concretely, China has agreed to build at least two factories for electric vehicles, electric cars. Okay, wow. Now, that's big, all right? Meanwhile, just as an aside, the U.S. is considering sanctioning electric vehicles from China, not letting any of them in. So it just puts the U.S. even farther behind, not only commercially, but in terms of the benefits of electronic vehicles when it comes to the environment, for God's sake, you know? So there's this strange reaction in the U.S. to anything good that the Chinese are doing, especially if they're overproducing. You know, they're overproducing things and hurting our economy. So suffice it to say that Hungary is a bellwether here of what should be happening in the rest of Europe. She is very patient. The Russians slightly less patient, but also patient. And as the Europeans realize they've been had by the United States in contributing to this debacle in Ukraine, as they realize that after November of this year, things are going to change one way or another after the election in the United States, they're going to finally come to their senses and say, are we really going to let our economies plummet just because the U.S. says we can't deal with Russia? And what about that one Nord Stream pipeline that still works? Hey, why don't we turn it on, for God's sake? You know, why do we pay liquefied natural gas premiums on this stuff? So will they wake up? Well, they haven't so far. I confess to being surprised at that. They are adults now. It's been almost 80 years since the end of the war when they were children and adolescents, okay? I may be impatient because I'm not going to be around for too many more decades. The Chinese have been around for millennia, right? You know, like more than centuries, millennia. And the Russians have been patient too. So they'll be happy to sit back and say, well, Europe, are you ready now? Are you ready to deal with us? And a lot has to do with the election, of course. I have to reflect on the brilliant mind of Jacob Sullivan, who, after all, is the principal advisor with Blinken, the Secretary of State, to President Biden. As you know, just before the events in Gaza, just before Hamas attacked Israel, Jake Sullivan wrote an article in Foreign Affairs saying, we take great pride in the fact that the Middle East, Southwest Asia, has never been so peaceful. And actually, we've solved very important problems, including, of course, the situation in Gaza. That was published 3 days, if memory serves, before the attack on Gaza. What's he saying now about Ukraine? Well, last week, a week ago today, there was a big confab with the Financial Times was sponsoring it. And I took some notes here on what Jake Sullivan said about Ukraine, and it's worth my not paraphrasing it, but here it goes. We hope that Ukraine will have the capacity to hold the line, end quote, over the course of this year and be able to mount a counteroffensive in 2025. That's next year. They're gonna recapture territory Russians have taken from them. Now, the Financial Times is usually not a caustic commentator, but they made it quite explicit. If we hold the line for the end of this year, well, November, the election is the end of this year, right? So here's the Financial Times. His, Sullivan's, comments about a potential counteroffensive by Ukraine represents the White House's clearest clarification of how it views the conflict if President Joe Biden wins re-election in November. As things now stand, says the Financial Times, that's a big if. So, the game plan, well, we could talk about Ukraine or whatever else you'd like to talk about, but with respect to Xi coming back to his visit to Western Europe, this was big. He didn't have to do this. It was planned well in advance. And he had a group of admirers in Belgrade, in Serbia, I should say, and in Hungary. And there are economic advantages to all this, as I pointed out, electric vehicles. Now, what happens next? Well, that's the big deal. Now, President Putin of Russia is going to visit Beijing. He announced a couple of weeks ago that that would be in May. Okay, well, what is it now? The 11th of May. So next couple of weeks, he'll be in Beijing if things fold out the way he predicted. What does that mean? That means a whole lot, let's say. The last crucial time when the two were together was February 4th, 2022, okay? They have seen each other at least twice since. Xi Jinping came to Moscow in March of last year, and Putin visited Beijing for the Belt and Road Initiative celebration in Beijing in October of last year. But these are not really important meetings. This one is. Why? Well, because things are coming to a head in Ukraine, they're coming to a head in Southwest Asia, and in all these things, the U.S. is diametrically opposed to this new alliance, and I use that term explicitly. It's not ostensibly a military alliance, but it is, okay? Now, what am I saying? I'm saying that here's a good way to put it. I've been watching Soviet leaders for a half century. That was my job with the CIA. I tried to put myself in the shoes of Russian Soviet leaders. Before February 2022, I didn't think that Putin would invade Ukraine. There were things I didn't know, okay? Things like Biden had promised Putin not to put offensive strike missiles in Ukraine. He did that in a personal telephone call on December 30, 2021. 3 weeks later, Foreign Minister Lavrov met with Blinken, and Blinken said, "What? We never made any undertaking like that. We reserve the right to put offensive strike missiles in Ukraine. They may be already in Poland and in Romania. So let's talk about maybe limiting. Maybe we'll only have three or four." And so Lavrov just recently revealed that. So on the 30th of December, promised not to put offensive missiles in Ukraine. 21st of February, no, 21st of January, the next month, Lavrov says, "Forget about that. We're not going to do that." And of course, the invasion came a month after that, on the 24th of February. Now, those were things I didn't really appreciate the significance of. And also the fact that shelling in the Donbas, the Ukrainian forces fortified, given weapons to, trained by NATO forces for 8 years, started shelling Donetsk and Lugansk in a way that was geometrically higher than ever before. And that started in the middle of February 2022, 2 weeks before the Russians went in. Now, that was available, but I didn't dig assiduously enough. It was available in OECD, a document, not OECD, the Office of Security and Cooperation in Europe, the organization OSCE, they monitored, they had people there. They said, "My God, this thing's gone up from 500 shellings a day to 13,000, okay? That was available, I didn't find it. But the real reason I was wrong, has to do with a question about China and Russia. Now, most people, including all the real savvy Chinese analysts, so American analysts or British analysts of China, told me, "Look, Ray, China's bedrock principle is non-interference in the affairs of other countries. Westphalia, okay? No invasions of other countries." So if you're asking me, Ray, whether China would ever bless Putin going into Ukraine, forget about it. It never happened. It made sense to me. And so my conclusion was based largely on the fact that if Putin did this, he'd do it alone, okay? And that didn't seem to be my idea of Putin, who I think is cautious sometimes, maybe overly cautious in the way he proceeds. So besides the fact that I was wrong, the thing is, we learn from our mistakes. What did that mean? That mean that China, that meant from the outset that China, when she met with Putin in Beijing on the 4th of February, this same month, okay, 4th of February, 2022, Putin broached this to him. He said, "Look, we've been deceived, we've been diddled, and the shelling has gone up, and you know, a bunch of Nazis, neo-Nazis, and we're gonna have to clean them out, okay?" And my idea is that she said, "Well, if you wait till the end of the Olympics, okay. The Olympics ended on 20 February 2022. 4 days later, the Russians invaded. From the outset, the Chinese defended Russia. Their rhetoric about the sacrosanct nature of the Westphalian Accords, what, 1648, for God's sake, you know, when they learned not to invade each other, okay, that sacrosanct nature sort of disappeared, even in the rhetoric. And the rhetoric said, you know, we Chinese, we evaluate things from the perspective of national core interests. And the national core interests, like we have in Taiwan, and like Russia has in Ukraine, well, in those cases, we examine each case on its own merits. Oh, on its own merits. So Westphalia, well, we carve out an exception for Putin. It was the most amazing thing. And it took a long time for many of my colleagues to appreciate, hey, this is a new ball game. Now we have Xi Jinping and Putin joined at the hip. It wasn't 2 years later, it was then, okay? And we could see it happen, okay? So what does that mean? That means that in February 4th, exactly, 2022, this meeting produced the confidence in Putin to go ahead and do what he's done. What he's done to the most part successfully. Remind people, everyone, that the twin missions of this offensive were to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. Demilitarization has all but succeeded. The extra help from the U.S. is not going to help. In my view, it's not going to be able to even see the Ukrainian armed forces such as they are through to November of this year, the election in the U.S. So that's demilitarization. Denazification, well, you know, this fellow Zelensky, the comedian who's not really very funny, okay? He is illegal on the 20th or 21st of this month. You know, there's supposed to be elections in democracies. It's supposed to be a democracy, right? Okay. So there was supposed to be an election. Zelensky said, there's not going to be any election, okay? So literally speaking, in a juridical sense, and you know, the Russians and the Chinese are pretty sticklers for juridical principles. I mean, they like to adhere to the international system of law set up by the UN and not to some alternative, what do we call it, rules-based international order. And so this meant something. So what am I saying? Well, things have come to a head in Ukraine. It's universally recognized by everyone but Jacob Sullivan and Tony Blinken, apparently, that the Russians have won. They're not going to be deterred from consolidating their wins, and that the only way to prevent unconditional surrender whenever, possibly before November election, is to talk to them. The facet that has been notably absent in dealings between Russia and the U.S. in my day, even over Cuba, and especially over Cuba, there are ways to communicate, often by telephone, but sometimes with these fancy teletype machines we had in those days, okay? But there were ways to communicate. Now there has been, to my knowledge, no communication between Lavrov, who was told by Blinken, look, forget about those offensive strike missiles that we said we wouldn't put in Ukraine. That's our privilege. We can do that. How about talking about just two or three of them, okay? So the Russians felt themselves not able to trust the United States. And so, long-winded way of saying, here comes Putin, maybe 2 weeks from now, into Beijing. He's greeted warmly by Comrade Xi. And what does he say to Xi? Well, I think I have pretty much right what he said back in February 4th of 2022. What's he going to say this time? I think he's going to say, Comrade Xi, thanks. thanks for your political support. And thanks for buying so much of our oil. As you know, the sanctions didn't work. As you know, we have the highest growth rate in all of Europe. Everybody else is negative growth, 3%. Yeah, thanks very much. Now, we still have this problem. We have the November election coming up in the United States. God knows what these guys are capable of doing. And so my options are, you know, do I send my forces forward all the way to the Dnieper River and say, okay, now are you ready to negotiate? Or do I talk with Washington in extra channels, out of the normal, and try to persuade them, look, we don't like your policies, Biden administration people, but we dislike Trump's policies even more because he doesn't have any policies. He's so erratic. He's so unprincipled. He's so unpredictable that President Putin has said that he favors Joe Biden. My God. Surprise? Of course I was surprised. Is Putin speaking unnecessarily about the U.S. election? What's he saying? How could it be, after all Biden has done, that Putin would prefer predictability? My God, that's really good. Was he putting us on? Is he just playing us? Well, 2 weeks later, Biden in one of his campaign stops said that Putin was, what did you call him? Oh, yeah, he's I don't want to say it here, a son of a bee, okay? In Russian, sukin sin. It sounds even worse, and that was all over the Russian media. So Putin was asked the next day, you said you prefer Joe Biden because he's predictable? What about what he said yesterday? He called you a sukin sin. And Putin smiles, you see, that's what I mean. He's predictable. We prefer him. Well, I don't know. But I think if you take that as a premise, that this is a big premise, and that Putin would rather deal with Biden and his people if he were able to talk some sense into them. The chances are he cannot do that. And so what he'd be saying to Xi Jinping is, look, I have these five options, okay? I can go ahead and do the thing now, finish this off, and create a clear debacle, clear defeat for NATO and the United States, and Biden will lose. You know, he can't survive something like that. Or I could proceed more gradually and make overtures to see if this thing can be watered down or at least pacified until the election. Or what do you think, Comrade Xi? I have these options now. My forces are so much in the ascendancy that they can plow through any of those points in the Ukrainian lines that they need to. And we don't want to conquer and occupy the rest of Ukraine. I don't even want to occupy the part of Ukraine that remains to the east of the Dnieper River. We're satisfied with what we have. We could have a cordon sanitaire, a belt that would give us security from long-range ballistic missiles. But let's see what's going to happen. So what's she going to do? Well, she's going to say, well, look, last time this worked beautifully. You came with your decision and I blessed it. So you decide, and you and your people are pretty, pretty perspicacious. And probably if you do prefer Biden, you'll know what to do in terms of making it clear to these young people like Sullivan and Blinken what the price they'll have to pay if you relent and don't take the rest of Ukraine up to the Dnieper. So Think about it, and I applaud you for proceeding cautiously. And not only that, you have my support, but I think the United States is beginning to appreciate that we are not going to put up with a lot of foolishness on the part of the U.S. Seventh Fleet in the South China Sea. We have already, just yesterday, driven off one of these very fancy U.S. destroyers that was sailing close to the so-called disputed islands, but which are under international law, ours. And so, in short, Mr. Putin, Comrade Vladimir, if you get involved in the dust-up in Ukraine or in the Baltic or somewhere like that, the U.S. is going to have to count on our proceeding to defend our rights in a much more aggressive way in the South China Sea and in the Taiwan Straits. Now, we're not going to invade Taiwan. We don't want to invade Taiwan. We just don't want Taiwan to think it's independent or be bristling with U.S. missilery and other arms. So this is what we're prepared to do if you get into a real dust-up in Ukraine. If one of those fancy new missiles from the United States or from Great Britain or from France or some other place hits something really vital and you want to retaliate, we're with you just as we were before. And that will be what the discussions that ensue in Beijing later this month between Xi and Putin. That's the way they'll take shape. And we have the precedent of two years plus ago, February 4th, 2022, again, just weeks before the invasion of Ukraine. I had one other thing. Oh, yeah, I just want to mention this. This is not necessarily what Putin will be telling Xi, but a professor at the University in New Mexico has done a really thorough research job on what international law says about who owns those islands, those disputed islands in the South China Sea. Now, guess who owns them under international law? China. How do we know that? Well, this professor has gone into all treaties and all, going back a couple centuries, okay? All kinds of data in writing, the French approving what Vietnam had. In other words, there's a principle in international law that if a colonial power breaks free, its international boundaries would be the same as they were under the colonial power. And under that principle, all these things belong to China. Philippines, forget about it. That comes later. Now, here's the flaw in the ointment. The Philippines and the United States have a mutual defense treaty. The Philippines, under this young Marcos fellow, have been giving the U.S. many more military bases in the Philippines and has been sending what passes for their Coast Guard ships onto some of these islands or real near them. And the Chinese have blown them off with water cannon, for God's sake. So to the degree the Philippines is feeling its oats, and this young Marcos says, well, what do we got to lose? We've got the U.S. behind us. The Philippines is quite capable of putting the United States in a very, very embarrassing question as to whether it wants to fulfill its treaty obligations to defend the Philippine Coast Guard, for God's sake, on these islands. So, you know, when I first saw that professor's treatise, I read half of it, so very pretty long. I was very convinced, but I'm not a Chinese expert. So I asked Ambassador Chas Freeman, and luckily he just responded this morning and said, yep, yeah. It was on its way to a peaceful resolution in accordance with this international law. And then the U.S. Decided to throw its weight around and create the kind of stress, the kind of friction, the kind of danger that now exists around these little islands that don't really amount to much, except that they do lie astride the major navigation channels and are very close to the Chinese coast. So there's that too. So in sum, Russia and China joined at the hip. They described their alliance as exceeding any normal alliance, has no upper end. They said that on the 4th of February, 2022, not to belabor a point, okay? But you gotta sort of realize that this is what it is, okay? Now, what's Biden being told? My God, I'll finish with this. Sorry to be so long-winded. But, you know, Biden met with Putin once, 16 June 2021, his first year in office. Now, he met with him because he got really upset about how many Russian troops were coming to the border in Ukraine. And Putin had issued a warning saying, look, don't send any more ships into the Black Sea. You know, that's gratuitous. We don't like that. And indeed, Biden said, hey, you Navy ships, go visit Greece. It's much more pleasant than going through the Black Sea. And then Biden called Putin and said, look, we should have a summit. I'm really good at person-to-person relations. Always have a summit. Out of the blue. On June 16th, they met. Now, we don't know much about that meeting, but we do know what kind of brief Biden was given to realize how exceptional the U.S. and how much in charge it was with China and Russia at each other's throats, hating each other. Got that? Okay. How do I know that? Biden himself. After the meeting was over, the only thing of any consequence that he said is, you know, I probably shouldn't say this because we don't want to divulge private conversations. But, Putin needed to know, and I, you know, reminded him that China is challenging the whole world, including Russia, that there's thousands of miles of border between the two of them, that they have traditionally been enemies, that China is pretending not only to be a major economic power, but a major military power. So we realize that Putin is being squeezed by China. Nothing could have been farther from the truth, okay? And yet, that was what he said. I mean, that's what Biden said. He said, they're trying to pull him on the plane. He said, once again, I just want to remind you, Russia's being squeezed by China. Well, the next year, now that's June 2021, the next year was spent by Xi Jinping and Putin doing their damnedest to dissuade the U.S. if that was the case. Look. And of course, the ACME with this new agreement, strategic agreement, on the 4th of February, 2022, but they couldn't get through. The question is, can they get through now? And that all depends on whom they listen to. And just to finish up for sure now, they're still listening to people like Michael McFaul, former ambassador to Russia under Obama. What a, I won't use any adjectives, but here's an example. Xi Jinping made a very big visit to Moscow in March of last year, okay? After it was over, 2 days later, Putin said something that Michael McFaul, Ambassador McFaul, thought that Beijing would take askance, and he wrote authoritatively, as he always does, Biden has gratuitously humiliated Xi Jinping right after they met. Well, this does not bode for a good relationship between the two. That afternoon, the Chinese Defense Ministry announced that they had upped the amount of naval and air and ground forces training and mutual training and joint training and so forth. So, you know, this was crazy. I forget exactly what straw Michael McFaul was grasping at. I can look at my record, but it was so outlandish. See, they look like they're great friends, but no. He's been humiliated. That Putin gratuitously humiliated Xi Jinping. Well, it's far from the case, but the reason I mention that is because Biden and his entourage are still listening to people like McFaul and like those other people who used to run Russian analysis for the CIA, for God's sake, or for the intelligence community. I'm talking about Fiona Hill and all those people. And, you know, so the question is, well, how do we get them to watch you and me? That's the issue here, so that they can learn what's really going on in the world and learn that there are limits to what the U.S. can do. And I just refer back to our earlier session a couple of weeks ago where I branded U.S. exceptionalism an infantile disorder after the words of Lenin describing left-wing communism an infantile disorder.
Ray, recently in Russia, they were talking about non-strategic nuclear weapons and even Navy getting prepared for any sort of escalation in Ukraine. Do you think what would be that red line for Russia to use these type of weapons, in your opinion?
Well, Nima, if I can make another confession, I was surprised that Russia made it very clear that they were going to be exercising what they call non-strategic weapons, missiles and so forth, tactical nuclear weapons. That came out of the blue. Of course, they made it clear that it was a direct reaction to Macron's idea that he would send soldiers, he would send troops into Ukraine. And Cameron, the British foreign minister, who used to be prime minister, God help us, saying that, oh, when we give our missiles to Ukraine, they're free to hit the heartlands in Russia. We don't control that. They can do that, sure. Well, there was that. And then there was just a lot of stuff going on. And Xi Jinping was in Western Europe at the time. And I'm not sure, but I think it's probably the case that the Chinese and Russians had talked together in Moscow at the time, not Xi Jinping, but his lieutenants, and said, all right, I guess we have to issue the kind of warning that we've not issued before. And so they said, we are exercising very soon tactical nuclear weapons from our sea-based forces and from our air-based forces, okay? Now, that's big. Up till now, the Russians have limited themselves to generic warnings saying, for example, don't forget that we have nuclear weapons, okay? I mean, it comes down to that. And as I've done before, I compare it to the last time when Russia and the United States were so close to nuclear war. That, of course, was the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. And John Kennedy was responsible for me coming down to Washington and learning some of this stuff. John Kennedy gave a wonderful speech at American University, June 10th, 1963. So do the math. October 1962, facing down the Russians and the Cuban Missile Crisis being resolved by bilateral contacts, okay? Teletype, but it worked, okay? Sparing the world, well, sparing the world a nuclear catastrophe, okay? So, October 62. Now, June 63. Both Khrushchev and especially John Kennedy had learned a lot at how close they had come. Put yourself in their shoes. My God, you know, be responsible for almost causing this kind of calamity. So Kennedy decided, well, he'd extend an open hand to Khrushchev and say, okay, you and I both know what it was like. You and I both know that we want the best for our children, and we need to be open to your interests. And above all, and this is the point here, above all, we must always avoid a situation where a nuclear power is faced with a choice between humiliating retreat or using nuclear weapons. 1963, all the way down to just, well, almost just this past year, the two sides have adhered to that, except now the U.S. is involved with NATO in a proxy war directly with Russia. Now, does proxy make any difference? Well, it does in a sense. But if it comes down to a choice between humiliating defeat, by whom? By Russia? No. Humiliating defeat of NATO and the United States, well, Russia would have to be afraid that Blinken, Sullivan, Nuland, all those people around Biden, faced with this choice, might just opt for the use of nuclear weapons rather than have a humiliating defeat right before the election. There's a personal stake in that, which I've talked about before. So here's the rub here. If the United States cannot be sure, and I'm sorry, if Russia cannot be sure, as I cannot be sure, that Blinken and Sullivan would not tap these military people who think that little low-yield nuclear weapons can be contained, and you know, we could show the, well, we should teach the Russians a lesson, you know, and that would get us through to the election. If Putin and his entourage cannot be sure that that would might be the case, they're going to be really, really on full alert. And would they use a nuclear weapon? I don't think they'd use it first, but Ryabkov, deputy foreign minister, has actually said 3 days ago that we know what our doctrine is. We set it down in 2020. Y'all can read it. That's what it says. But we're thinking of maybe revising that now, given the new circumstances. So will we use nuclear weapons to defend our country? Of course we will. Will we use nuclear weapons to protect all our assets? Of course we will. But there may be situations, as in the U.S. strategic doctrine, there may be situations short of that that acute need where we would consider using nuclear weapons. They haven't said that yet. But Ryabkov, really polished diplomat, deputy secretary of state, has said it just the last couple of weeks. It, you know, raises my back of my, the hair on the back of my neck real high, because they're playing for keeps. And with respect to Ukraine, this is a core issue. And if the United States is not able to recognize that Ukraine will not become a member of NATO, then this thing will go on forever. Here's Sullivan, as I said at the beginning of this thing, saying it can go to next year, and then you know, we'll see what happens next year.